for the
with bureaus in London, New York, Jerusalem, and Wainuli Amata. This is Giant Network News for the week. 2 weeks ending Sunday, July 3rd, 2005.
Okay, I know, it's been a fortnight since the last podcast. I had computer problems, my motherboard got fried, my ISP developed connection problems, my video screen turned green for no apparent reason. Trust me, you don't want to know. However, we are now back. I am, as always, your pseudonymous host, Tom Payne, with another edition of Shire Network News, the official podcast of the Anglospheric Group blog, silentrunning.tv. We're all a bit excited at Silent Running because we have a new contributing writer, and in keeping with our Anglosphere theme, he's from Scotland. And in answer to your unspoken question, yes, they do speak English up there, thanks largely to the Duke of Cumberland's decision to exterminate anyone who spoke Gaelic after the Battle of Culloden. Amnesty International was in a somewhat developmental stage in the mid-18th century, so there wasn't quite as much bitching about what happens to the losing side as there tends to be today. Some might see that as progress. Now, I've listened to several Billy Connolly CDs, and it seems that the Scots swear a lot, so a new writer, Dave, who goes by the name Warrior Monk on the blog, should fit in rather well on Silent Running. Coming up, the latest atrocities in Zimbabwe. We have an interview with Zimbabwe pundit about how his blog-based activism is aiding the opposition to Robert Mugabe.
I got a hold of an email from a Catholic nun who was detailing what she was seeing in the northern suburb of Harare, known as Heathcliff. And when I posted that to my blog, I was averaging at that point about 50 views a day. After I posted those and people got a hold of those emails, my readership spiked to over 1,500 a day.
But don't worry, Zimbabweans. Help is on the way. Your problems are over. Bob Geldof and Mitch Ewer organised a concert this weekend. There, that'll make those homeless starving people cheer up, I'm sure. And later on in what I think is probably a blog exclusive, I'll be talking to Pastor Danny Nalia, the Sri Lankan-born leader of a church in Melbourne, who's likely to go to prison for offending Muslims, and then refusing to apologise. But something tells me he's not likely to.
I was a missionary in Saudi Arabia, working underground in Saudi Arabia with the church there, where Christian worship is the number one criminal offense for having a Bible where you can get 70 lashes. And if you happen to talk to a Muslim about Jesus and he or she happens to dub you in, they get $6,000 as a reward, and you will be beheaded for that crime.
And of course, we'll also have Lawrence Simon joining us with his Full of Crap report. But first,
blog news.
In America, one of the Supreme Court justices, Sandra Day O'Connor, is stepping down, which means there's going to be an unbelievable shitfight in the Senate when the unelected President Bush, a conservative, tries to nominate, and get this, a conservative judge to replace her. Shocking, I know. It's going to be a complete circus. The Senate is full of bloviating egomaniacs, and if Ted Kennedy's head keeps inflating at the current rate, I'm not going to be surprised if it just explodes in mid-filibuster. Remember that deal they made about filibustering Bush nominees? Well, forget about it. The deals are off. This is the main event. And Washington insiders are going to carry on as though a Bush nominee will usher in a return to slavery. Which is ridiculous. You probably just want a judge favourable towards a form of indentured labour for not more than 12 years. You know what? 10-year-olds like going down coal mines and up chimneys. They learn a valuable trade. A very good and, so far, very neutral blog on the nomination is the Supreme Court Nomination Blog. They were up all night coming up with that catchy title, I bet. It's a sister blog to the SCOTUS blog, also well worth a look. But I must say, I'm intrigued by one novel suggestion at the blog Resistance is Futile, that Bush send Ann Coulter's name to the Senate. Hey, she's got a law degree. News is defined as something that someone, somewhere, doesn't want you to report. That's what they taught me in journalism school, and they were right. Only sometimes it's the media that doesn't want certain things reported. Like how President Bush's speech at Fort Bragg about staying the course in Iraq has seen a huge spike in his approval ratings. The blog Captain's Quarters reports a Gallup poll showing the President picking up 10 points on whether the US is winning in Iraq. He's up to 54% now. 12 points on keeping troops in Iraq until the situation improves, as opposed to setting an exit date for their evacuation. It's now at 70%. And up 7 points on whether he has a clear plan for handling the war in Iraq, up to 63%. Captain's Quarters noticed something unusual about this. It wasn't mentioned very prominently in the media, or indeed in some places, at all. USA Today instead regurgitated the results of its previous polling, while headlining its report, "Speech Fails to Quell Some Viewers' Unease." My unease comes from viewing a media which is so determined to portray its own view of reality that it will repress things which challenge that. Iran's elections were pretty much boycotted. There were many empty polling booths because, well, why bother? I mean, what's the difference between a hardliner who wants to nuke all the Jews and keep women in 7th century slavery versus a moderate who only wants to nuke Tel Aviv and bring the rights of women up to, say, the age of Voltaire? But now there's a new fascinating twist in the tale. The new president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, bears a striking resemblance to one of the students who seized the US embassy in Tehran in 1979, taking the staff hostage and humiliating then-President Carter. Some say he is, some doubt it. Gateway Pundit has a wrap-up of what people are saying. Either way, America has unfinished business with Iran, and the Americans I know tend to have long memories. Embassy staff being paraded blindfolded for the cameras, burned choppers at Desert One, ring any bells? If the new president was in fact one of the hostage takers, does this mean he can be legally snatched off the streets of Tehran by a US Marine Corps helicopter crew and dragged off to Gitmo? Hey, only one way to find out. Well, Karl Rove, God bless him, has done it again. He's pretty much the Brer Rabbit of politics. The Democrats and the MoveOn.org crowd accuse him of being a criminal mastermind and being behind anything bad that happens from their point of view. But that old Rover, he just lay low and say nothing. But every now and then he likes to sneak up on them and go, boo! After Senator Dick Durbin's likening of US troops to Nazis, Karl Rove made some provocative comments at a dinner. What do you think of this? Conservatives saw the savagery of 9/11 and prepared for war. Liberals saw the savagery of the 9/11 attacks and wanted to prepare indictments and offer therapy and understanding for our attackers. In the wake of 9/11, conservatives believed it was time to unleash the might and power of the United States military against the Taliban. In the wake of 9/11, liberals believed it was time to submit a petition. Moderation and restraint is not what I felt, and moderation and restraint is not what was called for. It was a moment to summon our national will and to brandish steel. At least that's what he was reported as saying. I wasn't really paying attention. When his face appeared on the news report, I was too busy kneeling in front of the TV set and saying, what is thy bidding, my master? James Taranto at Opinion Journal played a bit of a dirty trick on Andrew Sullivan by taking some of Andy's early writing on the war and using them to back up Rove's conclusions. He was making the point that Karl Rove wasn't saying anything now that a liberal hawk, such as Andrew Sullivan used to be, hadn't already said years ago. By the way, Andrew Sullivan's emotional state this week has apparently stabilised. He's gone from somewhat vexed to mild ennui. Roosevelt lied, Martians died. Iowa Hawk has uncovered the original script for Orson Welles' radio play War of the Worlds, broadcast to widespread panic in 1939. This time, America gets it right and doesn't allow its cultural prejudices to be imposed on the visitors from another world, with another set of paradigms which are equally justifiable from any perspective you like to care to mention. I mean, who are we to say that blasting civilians with heat rays and spreading a red weed across the world and feeding on the blood of humankind is wrong? What about Gitmo? What about Abu Ghraib? Are we really any better than a ruthless Martian in command of a death-dealing tripod war machine intent on exterminating us? Noam Chomsky would tell us to be ashamed, and he'd be right. Maybe we should offer them inoculations against Earth bacteria. Maybe then they'd like us. And that's about enough blog news for now. In the Australian state of Victoria, a new law outlawing religious vilification was recently passed. There were warnings before this happened that it could lead to a stifling of free speech, but not many people objected to it. The Jewish community was cautiously in favour. After all, vilification of people because of their religion is a bad thing, and it's not nice and people shouldn't do it. Fair enough. Okay. But legislating for public morality often leads to unintended and deeply negative consequences. If you're in America, go ask your grandparents about the Volstead Act, which brought in prohibition in the US. Blowback from Victoria's new law has been practically immediate. Two leaders of a Christian group in Melbourne, Catch the Fire Ministry, have been found guilty of breaking the law in a seminar they ran on Islam. Three white converts to Islam were in the audience. They'd been deliberately sent along to see if they could catch someone out, and their notes formed the basis of the prosecution case. The two pastors have been ordered to publicly apologise by taking out newspaper ads, at a cost of nearly $80,000, I might add, but they're refusing to do so, insisting they did nothing wrong and stating they will go to prison instead. One of them is Pastor Danny Nalia, who was born in Sri Lanka and who's been a Christian missionary in Saudi Arabia, so he's made a fairly stern stuff. He says one of the problems with the religious vilification legislation is that it wasn't opposed enough by religious groups because they didn't see it would become a club which could then be used to beat them with.
Church leaders did not believe that this bill was going to be a negative bill. They basically thought it's going to be an okay bill protecting religious freedom. Thus, we have people, just day-to-day Christians, writing, protesting against the bill. There were 5,000 letters generated through our campaign against the bill to the Victorian government. However, since the church leaders particularly did not get behind it to stop the bill, Mr. Brax went ahead with the bill with telling us that he's going to give us a clause which says religious discussions are exempt from the bill. And well, sadly, that's proven to be wrong today. The outworking of the bill in itself, when we applied for the religious clause, we were said that we don't qualify for it. So that's just a statement with no effect. So the whole problem with the bill is it's subjective, it's not objective. So anyone can claim vilification unlikely to an objective issue where someone, you know, if you know if there's tangible evidence. Here, if you claim hurt, the person who sues you and the person who is sued, like for example, the Islamic Council sued me. Now, I'm guilty until I prove myself innocent, whereas under the Westminster's Code, you're innocent until you prove yourself guilty.
What was it that you said that the Islamic Council objected to?
Well, what happened was after September 11th, I have been a missionary. I was a missionary in Saudi Arabia, working underground in Saudi Arabia with the church there, where Christian worship is a number one criminal offense for having a Bible where you can get 70 lashes. And if you happen to talk to a Muslim about Jesus and he or she happens to dub you in, they get $6,000 as a reward, and you will be beheaded for that crime because it's a huge crime to witness to a Muslim in Saudi Arabia. And so I had quite an understanding of Islamic teachings and its outworking. And that's after September 11, since we had a network of prayer warriors all across the nation, and since I have ministry across in 40 cities across Australia, many people wanted to know whether I could teach them what is in the Quran, and not what people on the street say, but what is really in the Quran. Now, since I felt that I was not qualified enough to talk on that topic, I invited a friend who is a scholar on Islam by the name of Daniel Scott. So it was Daniel who is the one who did the teaching. So we had a seminar for 250 Christians in a church where he explained the meaning of jihad, the comparison in between the Quran and the Bible, and how to effectively witness to a Muslim and love the Muslim community. And so into this seminar came three people who were Caucasian converts to Islam. And the most shocking news is that this Equal Opportunity Commission, who are the people who are supposed to monitor this law, had a Muslim lady working, Islamic lady working for them, who also worked for the Islamic Council of Victoria. And she basically was the person who sent the three spies into our meeting. So they basically came with pen and paper and took a 52-point complaint. So in other words, they came to wanting to be verified, and thus they took the complaint, and their whole mission was to shut us up, and they demanded an apology. We had a conciliation process for 7 hours and 40 minutes in the Equal Opportunity Commission. And we adamantly refused to apologize for speaking the truth.
I saw you outside the court on the news the other day, and you said that you weren't going to apologize despite being ordered, and you're prepared to go to jail.
That's correct. Because one thing is, we have become a very reactive community where we wait and we give room. I'm an immigrant in this country, and I stand by the saying that if you come to Australia and take your Australian citizenship, you become first Australian before you can be anything else. Don't come into this country carrying your baggage from your own home country. People talk about vilification. Australia is possibly one of the most racially tolerant nations in the world. I lived in two countries, traveled to 26 nations, met with the U.S. government. I've spoken in the White House, National Security Council, the U.S. Congress, and State Department. And with the wide experience I have, I would say Australia is one of the most tolerant countries in the world. And I've been standing by and saying we don't need vilification laws. We don't need these laws in this nation, particularly religious vilification. Race is something you're born into. Religion is something you choose. And you can choose anytime you want to choose what you want to choose. Thus, religion makes claims of truth. Race does not. And thus, when you make a claim of truth, you're invariably saying your religion is better than the other one. And in Australia, in a free democracy, if we do not have that right, then why do we have it? So we have decided that we will not bow down to the pressure. We have read verses from the Quran. We have been sued for reading the Quran because the law says truth is not a defense. And we have taken a stand not to bow down and face the issue.
One of the things you also said in your press conference outside the court was that this was the introduction of Islamic Sharia law by stealth.
Okay, what I mean by that is I lived in Saudi Arabia, and in Saudi Arabia, there is Sharia law. Under Sharia law conditions, you have the same problem as what we're facing in Victoria, where a person cannot, there is no free speech. You live under a dictatorship. And I lived also in Sri Lanka, my country of birth. And I saw a nation such as Sri Lanka slip into a place of government at one given time, controlling the people with laws which came into being. And I can see the first steps or the teething stage of such a situation in Australia. If you don't nip it at the bud, what will happen is my children and grandchildren will certainly not have a free and democratic society. And so thus seeing what's happening and seeing how Islam is spreading into Europe particularly, and the way they implement Sharia clauses into the British Constitution, I don't want that to happen in Australia. This law was pushed very heavily by the Islamic Council of Victoria to be passed in the Victorian Parliament, and we do know that very well.
Do you think that this law treats all religions, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, equally, or does one religion get specific treatment?
I believe the law in itself will treat all religions equally. I think the lawmakers themselves had good intentions when they brought the law, because generally politicians look through the eye of a straw, and whoever who gets their ear, they get things done. Sadly, the Christian community has been sitting back for a very, very long time, and church and state has not come together. Thank God that finally it's starting to happen. And since the Christians have not been speaking up, other groups have been speaking up and getting laws passed, and the Christians have been copying it and basically sacrificing their freedom. This law, basically, I believe it serves to everyone the same, but the difference is this. The Buddhist, Hindus and the Christians don't go around suing people, but the Islamic groups are very keen to do so. The reason behind that is Islam has much to hide, and they do not want things to be exposed. So these laws help them cover the bad parts of the Quran and present the good parts of the Quran. Because if Australians get to know the real teachings of Islam, they will not accept Islam as a faith.
What's going to happen if you and this other chap decide not to apologize and you do in fact go to jail? What will the effect of that be?
Well, my hope and prayer is that will have ripples across this nation. Even I'm amazed up to now the response level that I have got. I mean, I thought Christians will be excited. Christians are excited, tremendously excited, but also the non-Christian communities such as the atheists, who basically do not believe in God at all, many of them called me today. I'm amazed to hear the number of calls and emails. My email box is filled, and also is the telephone answering service was packed out with messages. To the extent, I had at least 5 atheists calling this morning alone to tell me how much they appreciated finally a Christian stand. And they did not just say that, but they said, we want to financially support you to fight this case. So what is happening right now is a nation is waking up, and I believe if that is even without us going to prison, but if it comes to the point of us going to prison, I believe people will really rise up and take a stand. And I just want to see that happen.
This isn't just a Christian issue. You think it's a wider issue than just a Christian one?
It is very much wider. For example, we have a pedophile witch sitting in an Ararat prison sued the Salvation Army right now, because Salvation Army conducted the Alpha course in the prison, and since he didn't like one of the scriptures which were read, he sued the Salvation Army from the prison. Then we have an occult leader who has sued a doctor who works for the protection of children, and when she exposed the website of this occult, which states their rituals are sacrificing children, drinking blood, and eating flesh. And because the doctor exposed this website, the doctor is being sued for verification. So what does this law mean? This law means tomorrow someone can sit in the church, and if someone says Satan is bad, a Satan worshipper can take the pastor to court.
That's insane.
It is. It is crazy. I mean, one of the classic examples of this law is also when India came into Australia and played a cricket match with the Australian cricket team. Two Aussie boys, 19 and 20 year olds, happened to draw up a banner which said, who is going to man the cookie mart? And the banner, basically the statement came out of the Simpsons program on television, where an Indian man has a cookie mart and he's 24/7 in his cookie mart. So what these boys are having was a little fun with a little statement saying, who is at the cookie mart, because all the Indians were at the cricket game. Because there's a stupid law, the Indian community, some Indians, basically sued the two boys and took them to court. Now, my question is, yes, they got an apology from them, maybe they got a fine, but do you think that those two boys are going to love the Indians in future. They actually would hate the Indians in future. This is a law which is going to cause division, not unity. I mean, we had a peaceful society. We never had religious tension here, but this law has caused one. We had a seminar for 200 people within the church. Today, this seminar has been exposed to the whole nation and the world.
That was Pastor Danny Nullier of the Melbourne-based Catch the Fire Ministry. You're listening to Shire Network News, the official podcast of silentrunning.tv. I'm your host, Tom Payne. Time now for Lawrence Simon.
Hi there, I'm Lawrence Simon, and here's the Full of Crap report for Shire News Network. Let's start off with the definition of the word apology. According to dictionary.com, it's an acknowledgement expressing regret or asking pardon for a fault or offense. It's also a formal justification or defense. And finally, it's an explanation or excuse. Richard Durbin, the senior senator from Illinois, made a horrific comparison between an out-of-date report on the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay Prison to the practices of the Nazi regime. Multiple times, Durbin had the opportunity to apologize for the insensitivity and inaccuracy of his remarks, and he didn't. And then, with tears welling in his eyes on the Senate floor, he did. First, it was insane comparisons to gulags by Amnesty International. After a day or two, we received word of an apology. Well, sorta. We received an excuse, actually. The spokesman didn't actually see anything firsthand, was only guessing. According to other reports, you know the drill. Now this. This reminds me of statements made by other famous people, liberals and conservatives and radicals alike, and then half-hearted, non-sorry apologies of the last definition we heard earlier. Ted Turner, Jane Fonda, Ingrid Newkirk of PETA, Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Al Sharpton, and Howard Dean. First comes the wild statement, then the speaker standing behind their remarks. And finally, there's a rushed apology that really doesn't show remorse and attempts to explain the comments, sometimes even vilifying the target even worse than the original statement. By the way, the first rule of holes, when you've dug yourself into a hole, stop digging. These people, they hold up their shovels, they cry, and they dig deeper. By the way, I left out a third definition from the dictionary.com. It's an inferior substitute. I think that's what we're seeing here is a growing trend of apologies of apologies. That's the Full of Crap report. Not my best, mind you. But you know what? I'm not apologizing for it.
Lawrence Simon there from This Blog is Full of Crap. Many of you will no doubt be familiar with the hideous scenes coming out of Zimbabwe at the moment, where a deranged lunatic called Robert Mugabe is seemingly intent on destroying his own country. The mainstream media are covering it, but not as extensively as perhaps it needs to be. Internet sites are coming into their own in terms of providing access to eyewitness accounts of what's happening and what can be done about it. I spoke recently to the author of Zimbabwe Pundit, who lives outside the country but still has friends and family back there and wisely elected to remain anonymous. I started by asking him about his own background.
Well, I was born in Zimbabwe and I was raised there. I went to school in Harare, both for primary and high school. My parents lived in northeastern Zimbabwe, and that's where I would go home for the school vacations and stuff like that. I was in Harare for during the school terms. After high school, I moved to Europe for a while for my higher education, and am currently settled somewhere in the Midwest in the United States.
A lot of people in Zimbabwe say the politics there is very tribal. What's your sort of internal background in Zimbabwe?
You know, that's one extreme to Zimbabwean that people speculate about Zimbabwean politics, that it's very tribal. The other extreme is the ZANU-PF extreme, which says that Zimbabwean politics is very race-based. And I don't agree with either of those statements for this reason. I am both Shona and Ndebele, the two major tribes in Zimbabwe. My mother is Ndebele, my father is Shona, and our family really hasn't had that tension that people are speculating about, and I wonder where they get it from. They're just, you know, I think they're talking about it. I think the greatest schism in the Zimbabwean society is a schism between the rich and the poor, the urban and the rural, taxpayers and recipients of government handouts in the rural areas. I think those are the bigger divisions that we should be focusing ourselves on.
some people are suggesting that criticism of Robert Mugabe or the regime in Zimbabwe is sometimes fueled by some sort of racial animus, that white Zimbabweans are criticizing Zimbabwe outside, and that's because they've lost their position of privilege.
Well, you know, this is, you can't avoid racial controversy when you talk of righting colonial wrongs and when you talk about redistributing land in a country like Zimbabwe. However, we do need to understand and you know, keep this in our minds when we think about Zimbabwe, that ZANU-PF will use that kind of rhetoric to picture themselves as victims. There's a lot of wrong going on in Zimbabwe that has nothing to do with black or white. Just poor politics and poor leadership on both sides of government, inside and outside of it.
Are both white and black Zimbabweans playing a role in the anti-Mugabe campaign?
Absolutely, absolutely. If you look even at the blogosphere, the Sokonela blog is run by several white civil rights activists. Women of Zimbabwe Arise is a project for looking out for the rights of Zimbabwean women, especially against this economic crisis, that is run and led by a white lady and features, of course, a majority of black women. So it's transcended the racial lines. This crisis has become to be a lot more about being human beings than about color of skin or tribe.
So Robert Mugabe has managed to do what very few other people have managed to accomplish in bring black and white Zimbabweans together.
He certainly has done that. That's one thing he's certainly done. And, you know, he can only blame himself for it, because right after independence in 1980, if you remember, he proclaimed a policy of reconciliation. So over the past 20 years, we have been working on getting our relationships right, and it's now apparent that in his heart, he didn't make that turn to embrace, white people and to embrace other people.
Tell me about what the situation is in Zimbabwe at the moment. We're getting a lot of information about that suggests that it's turning into a sort of proto-Cambodia. It's not quite Pol Pot in the killing fields yet, but it seems to be that Mr. Mugabe has, well, gone mental. His policies seem to be completely counterproductive.
Here's the situation in Zimbabwe. 50% of the economy was residing in the informal market. That has totally been raised. We had an 80% unemployment rate before this operation happened, and 80% of those unemployed people were working in the informal market. Now, they don't have a thing to do for income. We have a crazy drought going on right now. AIDS, HIV is killing up to 3,000 people every week. And it's winter in Zimbabwe right now, so there are kids who are sleeping outside in the open, not only without blankets and food, but without a shelter, and sometimes without their parents, because they've been killed because of the AIDS epidemic.
How could Robert Mugabe get away with this? I mean, where is his political support coming from?
Well, like I said before, you know, there's the two sides to this are the government handout recipients and, you know, the people who pay taxes. The people who pay taxes who are in urban areas are in the minority or are like me in the diaspora, and we really are powerless to effect regime change in Zimbabwe without conscientizing the Zimbabwean people in the rural areas who are in the majority. Here's what happens. There's a drought, there's a winter in Zimbabwe. Robert Mugabe and the government can take donations to people in the rural areas and hand them out and continue to bolster this myth that they are our miracle saviors, that they are people that we cannot dispense of because they're able to provide, and they are the, you know, the paternal leaders of Zimbabwe.
How much information about what's happening in Zimbabwe is making it onto the mainstream media in the West? Do you think the media is paying enough attention to what's happening there?
Well, there's no oil in Zimbabwe, so they don't care about what's going on there. If they cared, this would have been already, you know, taken up by other media houses. Just this week, Fox News over here in the U.S. picked up on the story. CNN earlier this week also had a couple reports. The Times Online over in England has been consistently following this because of the Tory MP, Kate Hoey, whom I reported that slipped into Zimbabwe and wrote a few articles for them. But the mainstream media hasn't been concerned, and that's the most disheartening part of it. This is a grave injustice on the scale of almost nothing else going on in the world today, but we continue to turn a blind eye to it.
What about blogs, have they been able to make a contribution to people's understanding of what's going on?
Well, the blogs have been great. There are a lot of people in Zimbabwe who are writing and putting information on the internet through blogs. I already mentioned Sokwanela blog. The ZimbabweSituation.com is another great blog that has good information about the current situation. There are several bloggers in the West who have taken up this issue, including Robert Mayer of Publius Pundit, the Gateway Pundit, Fallen Back. Several bloggers in the United States and even in Europe have taken up this issue, and blogs have provided the wealth of the information that's out there about what's going on in Zimbabwe. Not the press, not independent media in Zimbabwe, but people who write from their own experience that are bloggers.
Have the blogs been able to have an impact, though? Is it reaching out to more people than just other bloggers?
Well, let me give you an idea using my own blog, for example, as to what is happening. When this crazy Operation Muramasina happened in Harare, when it was just starting, I got a hold of an email from a Catholic nun who was detailing what she was seeing in the northern suburb of Harare, known as Heathcliff. And when I posted that to my blog, I was averaging at that point about 50 views a day. After I posted those and people got a hold of those emails, my readership spiked to over 1,500 a day. So people are getting this information. People have been responding. I get emails. I get asked what people can do to help the situation in Zimbabwe, and people leave me comments about what they think and about their rage at how the Western media is ignoring the Zimbabwe crisis.
Well, what can people do to help the situation in Zimbabwe?
Well, you know, first of all, if you're in a country that has a working democracy like the United States and the United Kingdom, of course Australia, where you are too, call up your representative. Let them know that you care about the human beings that are in Zimbabwe. That's the first thing we can do. We need to attract as much attention as we can to the humanitarian crisis that's going on as we speak right now. Second thing that people can do is obviously get in touch with organizations in Zimbabwe that are working to alleviate the distress, you know, for some of the least empowered people in the world. I'm talking about the poverty-stricken peasants in Zimbabwe. You can go to a website that is www.kubatana, as in K-U-B-A-T-A-N-A. .net. That is a website put by the non-governmental organization Alliance of Zimbabwe. And you can pick out organizations that are there to help, you know, whatever specific interest you're interested in. There is zimvigil.org, which is over in the United Kingdom. There is wezimbabwe.org as well. That's also in the United Kingdom, looking after the plight of asylum seekers in that country. So people can contact those places, people can go to those websites and read about what they can do to get directly involved in the crisis in Zimbabwe.
If nothing happens to stop what's going on in Zimbabwe, what do you think the end result of Robert Mugabe's policies is going to be?
Well, you know, back in March I wrote already that the end is in sight, that we are already experiencing what the former information minister Jonathan Moyo called sunset politics coming from ZANU-PF. 3 years from today, Mugabe has already said he will retire. I don't think he could live much longer or be healthy enough much longer after that to be involved in active politics. So the end is in sight. And I don't think that any of his henchmen around him will be strong enough politically to seize control of the party and certainly control of the Zimbabwean government. I think there are too many people who have been hurt, especially now after this crazy operation, which he has gone out and raised some of the property and developments that were put up by war veterans, by the way, after his tacit approval of violent takeover of farms. So I don't think ZANU-PF will have enough popularity to make it after Mugabe is gone. So at the worst, We are seeing, I am predicting, just 3 more years of this kind of a situation, and it won't last that long because they're running out of ideas and it's not working.
That was Zimbabwe Pundit. And that pretty much brings us to the end of Shire Network News for this week. One announcement, our competition to see if anyone would be brave enough to wear an I Heart Gitmo t-shirt anywhere within the city limits of Berkeley, California, has been won, and in fine style, may I add, by Aaron Justin Van Tassel, a 28-year-old PhD candidate in physical chemistry at Berkeley. He sent me a photograph of himself wearing a shirt, quite openly, standing on the steps of Sproul Hall, the heart of the university, and for that he wins a copy of Tammy Bruce's book, The New Thought Police, Inside the Left's Assault on Free Speech and Free Minds, and a DVD of Stephen Rosenbaum's documentary about the aftermath of 9/11, 7 days in September. Good going, Aaron. Until next week, may your God go with you.